Scott Bennett saying goodbye to a great friend. Hi, this is Stephen Pidgeon. We're dealing with another case of Suffer Moments here tonight. But tonight we're going to take a few minutes to discuss the life of my great friend, Scott Bennett, who apparently passed away this morning. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about Scott. And funny how these things happen in life. That, we meet people, and when you meet people, who do you know are going to be your friends, right? You don't know. And what is your walk going to be together? You don't know that either. But Scott and I, we walked a Celtic road, if you will, together. Gaelic road is more like it, but a Celtic road. He being born in Edinburgh, Scotland. And of course, my family coming from a long lineage of Irishmen, and so between the two of us, we would be known to break into the brogue there, particularly when Scott got excited, he would be known to do that. But it was funny; I didn't notice about him when I first met him. When I first met him, it was an interesting thing. But we're going to talk about that tonight. But it, as I say, you never know who is going to turn out to be your friends later on in life. And Scott turned out to be a great friend of mine. He and I having walked a pretty dangerous road together and also being comrades in arms, if you will, that we fought the same fight and we fought the same fight of, over the same basic issues, which is, of course, he being an army veteran was sworn to a constitution that he wished to uphold. And he was prepared to fight to the death. Against all enemies of the Constitution, foreign or domestic. Now, of course, my Constitution is a different Constitution because my Constitution is the scripture written by the finger of Yah and given to us through the prophets and through the Talmudim. And that is the Constitution I fight for, willing to give my life for enemies, foreign and domestic, of the sacred scriptures. But Scott fought, but Scott was also a man of faith, and he lived out a life of faith, even up until his last minutes, always proclaiming his faith openly and being a stalwart defender of the faith, really a model for all, members of the Commonwealth that they would stand by and defend their faith, valiantly. And one has to keep in mind that, Scott spent a great deal of time in Russia and also in Iran. I shouldn't say a great deal of time, but his interface was certainly significant with them, both in Russia and Iran. And of course, Israel, Iran being of an Islamic faith and Russia being of an Orthodox faith. And Scott, of course, was notoriously a Presbyterian Protestant in heart, mind, soul, and deed. And so it was interesting that he would defend the rights of Russians and defend the rights of Muslims under a banner of truth. Under a banner of truth. Now, let me just say this. Scott's passing, Scott was a person who was completely resistant to any kind of medical preventative treatment. And he and I were on the same page where this particular issue was concerned. My understanding, the cause of death with Scott was pancreatic cancer. And you guys don't know this, but I'll share it with you now, and not to defame Scott or to give any medical information that he hasn't already given. Because, of course, Scott created a website on Indian black salve. And one of the things that happened was that he had a, he had appeared to be a skin lesion in the, really right in the very center of his back. And it was pretty significant. And he went to the doctors to see what they had to say about it. And they said, well, we're going to do surgery and then we're going to do, radiation, chemo, and all of this. And of course, this is something that we just recently went through with Shane Knock, that he had a similar skin lesion on his back that. That of course had migrated and had become, it was no longer benign, but it had metastasized, and ultimately it threatened his bones to such a degree that his back actually broke in the last months of his life. But this is not the case with Scott. Scott did use the Indian Black Salve, and it did take remove the tumor. And this was several years ago. I'm going to say maybe 2 years ago that this happened, 2.5 years ago. And so he was able to move with great ferocity of life, if you will. He was quite lively, felt really good. And you're going to see by some of the pictures that he was able to move ahead quite well. However, on his last trip to Russia, you'll see this in some of the pictures. You can see that Scott had lost a great deal of weight. And in addition to that, he was also showing signs of getting older, not the young guy we used to be, right? And of course, you know, this is one of the things too, and I want to say this, but it's very important to say for everyone who loses someone close to them. You know, when a person dies, no matter how that person dies, this was something that was known to Yah from the very beginning. He knew the very minute, the very second of your death before he created you. He knew this. And so this is something that is well known in the eyes of Yah. And there's nothing that we can do to extend it. When Yah calls us home, we are called home. This is what it is, just the way it is. And so we lose Scott Bennett at such a time as this. But keep this in mind, Scott was a warrior until the very end. And he had waged a significant war, not on behalf of a myopic United States that had become completely corrupted and compromised, but rather the United States he believed in, a place of freedom, the land of the free, the home of the brave, the America that we once knew, the America we were taught. This was the America that Scott was defending, and he was defending it on behalf of others, and he was defending it on behalf of the truth as he saw it, knowing what he knew. And of course, how he learned what he learned was quite interesting, because we're going to get into that a little bit here today, and what he learned and why he took the position he did. Because of course, with much knowledge comes much sorrow. And this was something that, this is something that came upon Scott, right? That he came to understand a truth about America that he wasn't afraid of it in any respect, and nor did it slow him down. But he would always talk about how Yah had blessed him to teach his enemy, teach his fingers to fight. And of course, this is a quote that he used continually when we used to do the shows on Wednesday evening on Global Awareness TV. And Scott was routine in being able to devote his life to what he was doing. He spent all of his time working on this mission to bring forth the truth and to call American leadership to account as to why they were not following their constitutional duty and doing the best they could for the United States. And this was really a big question. This was a huge question for all of us. Why are you not doing the best that there is for the United States? And of course, we know now that there's a great deal of corruption, political corruption. There's bribery. There's people taking payoffs. There are people who have to bow to other people who have taken payoffs and kickbacks and money laundering schemes, and on and on and on it goes, really, in a great deal of corruption. And Scott also, you know, in running in some of the circles he ran in, and he was very good friends with a couple of key California attorneys, and of course, the brilliant Jim Fetzer. And, of course, you know, Jim, another PhD, had unearthed a great deal of evidence, And, you know, I find Jim Fetzer to be very persuasive in terms of his presentation of the facts. When he presents the facts, he presents them with a substantial body of documentation. And he and Scott worked together. And, of course, Scott and I used to work together with our good friend Michael Jay. And Michael Jay would always hold us to account. He would always hold us to a scriptural line, if you will. He would always hold us to remind us that we were children of faith in any of our presentations. And I don't know if Michael J is listening to this or not tonight, but Michael J, blessings to you, brother. And I share your loss in our losing Scott Bennett at this time. Okay, brother. And so at any rate, some of the information that was unearthed began to be really quite formidable. For instance, when Scott and his team had unearthed the corporate ownership of these 46 bioweapons labs in Ukraine, and this was just shortly before the Russian invasion, that this became unveiled, and that these bio labs were owned by a company that was owned in part by Hunter Biden and by the son of Nancy Pelosi, the son of Chuck Schumer, the son of John Kerry, and the son of Mitt Romney, who were all joint owners in a group. I don't remember exactly the name of it. It'll come to me at some point. But this group owned these 46 bioweapons labs that, according to the documentation that was provided to the United Nations, was working on gain of function, and they have been working on gain of function for the virus that would later be passed to Wuhan and then introduced in the United States. But they were also working on gain of function on race-specific viruses. In other words, they were looking for stuff that would be particularly effective against Slavic people. And so this was something that was going on. And Scott and others unveiled this information. And of course, the Russians had discovered all the paperwork when they came into the Donbass because they captured many of those labs. And of course, Vladimir Zelensky, as soon as the Russians entered in Ukraine, he shut down all those labs and burned all the records he could get his hands on. But it was a little bit late in the case of the labs they found in the Donbass because the Russians were able to seize those, and they took that documentation and placed it in front of the UN, proving what? Bio weapons in Ukraine, and proving that the United States was directly involved in developing bioweapons in a foreign country that was race specific as to Russians. Now, this idea of competing with Russia, I think is really kind of, I think it's problematic for most Americans. It's like there's really no reason for us not to get along with Russia. Of course, there's plenty of reason for banks not to get along with Russia, but that's another story. But we're not going to talk about the banks right now. Right now, we're going to talk about what happened with Scott. Anyway, when Scott unleashed the information on the bioweapons labs prior to the Russian invasion, or the Russian entry into Ukraine, rather, I should say, it kind of set the tenor for what was going on. And of course, we know that Joe Biden had engaged in quid pro quo in withholding $1 billion in aid to Ukraine until they fired a prosecutor that was looking into the corruption scheme that was through a Ukrainian company called Burisma, paying Hunter Biden a huge salary for knowing nothing and doing nothing, but to get access to Joe Biden as vice president of the United States. And so this is something that became, also became well known. But here you had Joe Biden, and of course, Joe Biden engaged in quid pro quo as vice president. So he accused Trump of that, and they impeached Trump for something that Joe Biden had done, claiming quid pro quo. This is a common tactic of the far left to project onto your enemy your own sins, a tactic well perfected by Hillary Clinton, for instance. And the Russians actually came forth and said, by the way, the so-called Russia hoax, claiming that Trump had done something in Moscow on concerning some prostitutes. And the Russians came out and said, oh, actually, that was Joe Biden who did that when he visited Russia in the late 70s. And again, an interesting facet, projecting onto Trump something that the Democrats had done, that the Democrats knew was deserving of impeachment. They just couldn't prove it on Trump because Trump didn't do it. Biden did it. So when Biden got into Ukraine, of course, Biden was engineering a money laundromat, which is what Ukraine is a money laundromat. And of the $184 billion that we've pumped in there, $184 billion that could have solved homelessness in the United States, $184 billion that could have solved our infrastructure, $184 billion that could have cured the border crisis, All of that money was instead dumped into Ukraine in order to, shoot out through the ceiling, military industrial complex stock prices and profits, and also to allow all these various Americans to fly into Kyiv and pick up a suitcase full of hundreds. And this was going on. And of course, Mr. Zelensky himself is a guy that is so much higher paid than Joe Biden. I mean, at least legitimately. I don't know how much Joe is getting behind the table, but Zelensky was able to buy a $40 million house in Miami. He was able to buy King Charles's family residence for $20 million in Britain. He bought a $200 million casino off the northern coast of Cyprus. He bought his mother a $10 million house in Egypt. He's pretty ticked off that everybody knows the addresses, but this is nonetheless what he's done. And his wife runs around. She just spent a couple of million bucks on a Bugatti, and she runs around like the stuffed shirt, snot-nosed princess that she thinks she is. And as I say, she needs to enjoy it while she can because her life has got a very short lifespan, in my humble opinion, and it's only opinion. But so Scott was uncovering these kinds of things, and he was laying them out, and he was not afraid to go public on these issues. And so his opinion was quite sought after in both press TV in out of Iran and also in Russia. And so he was a very popular commentator on RT. He was a commentator on Izvestia, on Sputnik, on Russia One, and really on Pravda, on all the main Russian television channels. Scott would be interviewed, practically once a week. And some of his analysis, which was a psyop analysis, you remember that Scott was a PhD. Some of his analysis was poignant beyond belief, and in some cases quite prescient as to what he was seeing. But his poignant analysis was really very good, talking about the kinds of things that were there. And so because of this, Scott would not withhold his opinions about the matters that about the matters he believed to be true. Okay, so Dave Clinton says, console Scott's friends, David Rodriguez. Yeah, well, all the people who are mourning Scott's loss, my condolences go out to you. As I was saying on RFA earlier today, the pipes are calling you, Scott. The pipes are calling you. From glen to glen and down the mountainside, the summer's gone, all the roses fallen. Tis you must go, but we must bide. So this is what we see. So modern day Samaritan woman says, what happened to Scott? Well, Scott passed away this morning, and it appears that he died from pancreatic cancer. All right. So let's take a look at a little bit of background on Scott. So Scott Bennett, a U.S. Army Special Operations Officer. He was in the 11th Psychological Operations Battalion of Civil Affairs, Psychological Operations Command. And he was a global psychological warfare counterterrorism analyst. Formerly with defense contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, he received a direct commission as an officer and held a top secret sensitive compartmentalized information, a TSSCI security clearance, and worked in the highest levels of international counterterrorism in Washington, D.C., and at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Florida. He had developed and managed psychological warfare theories, products, and operations for U.S. Special Operations Command, U.S. Central Command, the State Department, coordinator for counterterrorism, and other government agencies. So the long and the short of it was, he was a gifted mind with a gifted talent in the PSYOP world. Okay. He knew what was going to work as a PSYOP in various situations. He served in the George W. Bush administration from 2003 to 2008 and was a social science research fellow at the Heritage Foundation. His writings and lectures seek to enhance global awareness and understanding of modern psychological warfare. And the international military intelligence community and global surveillance operations being artificially generated under the specter of national security. He's written exclusively on the intelligence community's surveillance activities addressed by Edward Snowden's National Security Agency, Central Intelligence Agency materials. And since 2010 has filed numerous military government whistleblowing reports with congressional committees, including the intelligence, the armed services, the government oversight and reform, the homeland security, the judiciary, the foreign affairs, the banking, and the terrorism committees, where he has filed one of the largest, one of those reports, of course, was Shellgate. And he has communicated with over 100 federal representatives, senators, senior military officers, and Pentagon officials and journalists about the scandalous abuses of power and the deception being employed against the American people by its own military intelligence community, and filed legal action against Booz Allen Hamilton and the Department of Defense for their involvement in secret Swiss bank terrorist finance operations, which he uncovered with the help of the Union Bank of Switzerland whistleblower Brad Birkenfeld. His educational background includes a Bachelor of Science in Advertising and a Spanish minor from San Jose State University in California. We could have had a Spanish minor, but I can tell you, he was totally fluent in Spanish. And a Master of Arts in International Business and Public Policy from George Mason University in Virginia, and a PhD in Political Theory from the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. Okay, yeah, I can tell you when we were in D.C., there was a point where I looked at Scott because we were, you know, we've been infiltrated so much. There were people listening in on us and people walking in, and you know, people had hacked Tory's computer and people breaking into our hotel rooms. So I looked at Scott and I said, Scott, necesitamos hablamos solo español, solamente en español. And so he broke into Spanish and that was it. And he wouldn't come out of Spanish for the next couple of hours. And he was actually upstairs interrogating the maids in Spanish. Once I set that trigger loose, well, that was it, you know. Anyway, yeah, so Scott was very fluent in Spanish. And so here it is, former military psyops officer Scott Bennett being forced by NATO to duke it out with nukes, saying Russia was being forced by NATO to duke it out with nukes. Now, he said this back in September, that NATO was going to force a nuclear war. And NATO is forcing a nuclear war. I mean, we were so close to it this week. And Vladimir Putin decided that he was going to show something, which, of course, you know, now he showed something to the West, and now he has to explain to the West what he showed them, because the West is so dense. You know, it's like Keir Starmer, you know, they've nicknamed him the Dense Pack, right? Because some of these guys just, they don't hear anything, right? Their forehead is set like steel because the rest of their brain is solid iron. And so this is the kind of thing that you see. And so when you look at, what Putin did yesterday was to launch this ICBM. Now, Scott Ritter would tell you the significance of this ICBM that was launched, because the ICBM that was launched against one particular target in what used to be Ukraine, but is now part of Russia in the Donbass, the Russians wanted to demonstrate, first of all, the range of it, which it was shot from Astrakhan, which was quite a distance from Ukraine. Its target accuracy was precision and pinpoint. And it demonstrated the MIRV capability, and the MIRV capability of this ICBM was incredible. And especially when you watch the videos of these coming in, they're coming in at ridiculously high speeds. And in fact, the speed is Mach 10, or 10 times the speed of sound. So roughly 7,500 miles an hour, these missiles are coming in. And, but this particular missile, and this is something that Scott Ritter is an expert on, because Scott Ritter was in the negotiating to try to limit and prohibit and put to bed intermediate range missiles being staged in Europe. Now, a DJT is the one who pulled out of that treaty and said, oh, we're just going to go ahead and stage intermediate range missiles in Europe, not recognizing that he was, of course, in the middle of an arms race and that the United States had already fallen way behind in that arms race, way behind. Even though we had intermediate range missiles, we did not have the hypersonics that the Russians had. And now the Russians have moved up into a level of hypersonic that's just kind of ridiculous. They're well beyond our technology and our capability, and they're certainly well beyond any anti-aircraft defense that we might have. Whether you're talking the THAAD or you're talking the Patriot or you're talking any of these other things, these systems are good systems for 1990s kind of situations. They're certainly effective against aircraft, some aircraft. However, even then, you know, when you look at something that was developed in the 90s, and I'll explain to you how this, why some of these weapons are ineffective. Some of these weapons are ineffective because you have a situation going where you have, you've got like an F-16. Okay. So F-16 has a certain amount of radar. It has a certain amount of range based upon its gas tank. And then you have a certain amount of range of its missiles. And so when the F-16 comes up in the air, it sees so far and it can shoot so far. So when you look at the SU-35 sees about 40% farther than the F-16 and has missiles that can go twice as far and twice as fast as the F-16 missiles. In addition to that, and this is what the Israeli Air Force discovered when they tried to get into Iran. They were coming into Iran with 100 aircraft. They had six refuelers in the air, American refuelers in the air. And these were F-35s, F-15s. And I think there might even have been some American support aircraft in that, even though the U.S. denied that there were. But there were 100 aircraft in the air that were going to invade Iranian airspace at carrying approximately six munitions apiece, which would allow them to make 600 strikes in Iran on military targets. But once again, you have a situation going where the F-35 has a particular kind of radar that goes out a certain direction, and it has weapons that fire a certain range. Well, when the F-35s neared the Iranian border, their radars picked up the fact that the S-400 systems that Russia had deployed in Iran had already locked on all of their aircraft. Now, what it means that they're locked on when these batteries are locked on to the aircraft, this means that the missiles that are going to be fired from these batteries, this S-400 battery, is already targeted and is going to hit that plane. It's not going to miss that plane, and particularly a hypersonic missile coming out of an S-400. So this is why the attack never manifested itself over the Iranian border, because once the pilots recognized that all of their aircraft had been locked on by S-400 systems that was going to blow them all out of the air. And this is not old, tired F-16s that the Danes have given the Ukrainians. This is brand new, updated F-35s that the Israelis have tweaked to try to get a hot rod out of them. And all of these were recognizing that they've been locked on by the S-400 system, were about to be blown out of the air. And so they hightailed it and went the other way in order to hold on to their aircraft. Okay, so you understand how this works, that when you have you might have a very good plane, but when that plane has a shorter radar and has a shorter throw missile, it's subject to being blown out of the sky by a more advanced air defense system. This is why the F-16s haven't been flying in Ukraine, by the way, for the same reason, because they're going to get shot out of the air. And so at any rate, the fact is that NATO has been pushing. And of course, one of the great feats that had happened over a long bouts of blood, sweat, and tears was to put the intermediate range ballistic missiles to bed, because the intermediate range ballistic missiles cause war to break out in a very short period of time, as compared to a long range missile that's going to take much longer to get in the air and air defenses may be able to be deployed and you've got plenty of notice and so on and so forth. Short range missiles can go up and then it's over. And the whole theory was that, well, Russia's a sitting duck. We can put our short range missiles in Ukraine and then blow up all the major targets in the European section of Russia. And Russia said, no, you're not going to put anything in Ukraine like that. And but since that the United States has backed out of the Intermediate Range Treaty, Russia said, okay, well, let me show you what we've got. And so they put this Oreshnik missile into play yesterday. And this particular missile is extremely deadly. It's extremely fast. And they announced its target capabilities. So its target capabilities can hit the far southern tip of Portugal from Astrakhan or other places inside Russia. So 100% of Europe is in range of these missiles. 100%. And the target time, I think the longest target time is 11 minutes to London, 8 minutes to Berlin, something like this, 9 minutes to Paris, and from launch. And these are MIRVed missiles. So I believe the one that they fired into Dnipropetrovsk had 24 MIRVs that came off of it. You can imagine if those were 24 75 kiloton nuclear weapons, the kind of damage that that would do. And they came in at very high rates of speed. So what Scott was saying back here, the former military psyops, Scott Bennett, was saying that Russia was being forced by NATO to duke it out with nukes. Now, you have to keep in mind that, you know, the lot of the theory that is being said now is that nobody can survive a nuclear war. Well, that depends. Let me give you an example. If there was a preemptive strike by Russia on the vast bulk of our strategic nuclear weaponry, they were able to hit it very quickly, then the chances of us being able to get anything off the ground would take us 10 minutes to get anything off the ground. And in that period of time, Russia could strike twice. And so this is a very significant issue, because it's true that nobody will survive a nuclear exchange, but somebody might survive if only one country is totaled and wisely decides that it's not going to end the earth. Okay. All right. So Scott was born in Edinburgh, Scotland, and his family was, they were Scottish, and he actually lived with his grandparents for a while in Edinburgh, And in Edinburgh, he learned a long Scottish tradition, including, like, his grandparents were stalwart members of the Presbyterian faith in Scotland, a Protestant faith that had been long established and was in the bone marrow of the average Scotsman before we got to the modern trend that was basically destroyed by that son of Dracula, Prince Philip. And so here you can see Scott. He decided to show up for the Highland Games in his green kilt. And this was taken in, actually, in California this year for some Highland Games. And he looks fairly healthy in that picture, doesn't he? All right. Fierce defender of the faith. Now, here's Scott, and here he is talking with our good buddy Alex Jones. Now, Alex Jones, you guys may not know this, but I'll share this with you. But two of the most common Welsh names are Smith and Jones, okay? Those are Welsh names, Smith and Jones. And so here you see Alex Jones, obviously the son of a Welshman. And, of course, Alex is going through a lot of difficulty right now. And, you know, as much, you know, he's taken a lot of hit, a lot of flack, and everybody says he's this, that, and the other thing. But nonetheless, because of a report he made about Sandy Hook, he was sued for damaging the surviving families. And they, you know, the judge kept upping the damage award. And really, I think the reason the judge upped the damage award was to simply make sure that he was going to take all of Alex's assets. And, of course, Alex was not well protected coming into his broadcasting, because, of course, I think Alex had an assumption that the First Amendment still had some validity in this country, which it does not. The First Amendment is totaled. It's tanked. And there are people, of course, on the left that want it even more totaled than tanked. They want to be able to have, they want to execute censorship, particularly on social media. But nonetheless, there is a judge looking over, I think the judge is looking over the sale at auction of InfoWars to The Onion. I don't know anything about that case, so I'm not going to comment on it. But I will comment on this, that where Alex Jones is concerned, you have to remember that they can take away all of your stuff, Alex. They can take away all your toys. They can take away your cameras. They can take away your studio. They can take away your business license. They can take this, that, and the other thing. But they haven't taken away Alex Jones. They still haven't taken away your brain. They haven't taken away your mouth. This they haven't done. And just as Mike Adams had his whole world destroyed when he was demonetized and so on, Mike Adams went on to form Brighteon, and he's, you know, recouped and is regrouped and is doing quite well. And I think Alex Jones is going to redo is re, going to regroup too. He's going to regroup and do well. And even though he's got, I've seen him in some of these things that he's done recently. He's a troubled guy. He's troubled in his heart, and he's heartbroken over his life's work being taken away from him. Over, you know, really. Well, I'm not going to comment on the case, but the fact that he's going through that kind of trouble, I just want to give a word of encouragement to Alex Jones. It's going to be okay, brother. Your mind is still here, and your mouth is still here. Your intelligence is still here. Your ability to stand up again is still here. Yah takes a lot of this stuff away from you, strips it away from you, so that you recognize that all that stuff doesn't have any meaning. What does have meaning is Yah and what he has done in your life. That's what has meaning. And so this is why what I'm saying to you, Alex, is that be confident, okay? Be confident, be strong, and stay in there, brother. You're going to be okay. All right. Now, this is Scott Bennett, and he's at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. And you can see that the gal that he's talking to is a Russian broadcaster, and she's holding a microphone that says Russia, Russia, which of course is Russian for Russia. Ha ha! Imagine that. Yeah. And at any rate, when Scott traveled into Russia for the St. Petersburg International Forum, it was a very good trip. He wanted me to go with him, and I couldn't do it. And as much as I would have liked to have gone with him, you know, I was in Russia in 2016 when Trump was getting elected in 2016, which was an interesting time. And it was also, I think, kind of fortuitous that I was there in 2016 because I was shown basically emerging Russia. And this was something that was that my friend Yuri Mikhailovich wanted to show me at the church. And we were in Kursk, by the way. We were in Kursk, a part of that trip. And also to show the modernity that had come to Russia. Russia was no longer struggling to pull itself out of the poverty of the Soviet Union. It was now out of that poverty and was now moving well into a bourgeoisie, a much more bourgeois environment. And I can tell you, Kursk, it was really quite evident. That my friends David and Ina were living really Western lifestyles. They had bought a house. They bought a house that used to belong to an American missionary. It was quite nice. It was a beautiful modern house. And Ina was driving a, I believe, a new Honda. And David was working as a truck driver and was making good money doing it, driving truck in Russia, driving goods in Russia. And which was crazy because when I first went into Kursk, Kursk was still, you know, living the old Soviet times, right? Where there was no paint on any of the roads and, you know, and people were driving old military vehicles and Ladas and Volgas if they could get them to run. And this time when I was there in 2016, while I was staying in a perfectly modern, you know, hotel that had, you know, German fixtures in the bathrooms and, you know, practically Otis elevators running up and down. It was very modern. It was absolutely first rate. It was a, you know, 4-star hotel there in downtown Kursk. And the old street that we used to go up and down and wait for the tram to come by was now a modern street with overpasses. And there were, you know, car dealerships on either side of the street. So I was kind of stunned. And then, of course, the thing that was really convincing for me was the music. Now, the last time I had been in Russia, I think, I don't know, 2004 or five, something like that. We were trying to work with the music team and, you know, David was on the music team and, but some of the musicians were just, they just weren't there. They didn't have instruments, to play and they didn't have the availability to play. They didn't have the idea of being able to train any of this stuff. By the time I get there in 2016, they've got nothing but world-class people on the worship team. I mean, world-class. Their worship team was absolutely spectacular. And so Yuri comes in, he says, oh, I want you to criticize the, you know, come up here and criticize the worship team. Of course, what he really wanted to do was show off the worship team and kind of embarrass me because I wasn't a quality musician that they were. Well, okay, fair enough. I mean, I'm not the kind of person who is going to belittle other musicians when they're playing well. And these guys were playing very, very well. And I told the lead singer, I said, you know something, it's really good to hear men sing like men, which is how they were singing. And the group was just an outstanding level of performance. But they asked me to perform one Saturday night at the church. And so I did. And I sang the song, interestingly enough, and I did sing in English. I sang the song, God Bless This Child. And of course, you know me and the word God, I'm not keen on that. But the words were, when it was written in the 50s, God Bless the Child. It's an old Billie Holiday song. And, you know, them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, but it still makes news. Your mama may have, your papa may have, but God bless this child that's got his own. And this was really kind of a blessing on Russia at the time. I didn't know it at the time. I was just singing a song that I knew. But it was a blessing on Russia because Russia was getting its own. It was getting its own, was standing on its own 2 feet as its own sovereign nation again. Very important point. Now, Scott understood this when he went into St. Petersburg. He unfortunately, now if I had gone with him, I wouldn't have allowed him to do what he did, which was he went to the convention center and stayed at the hotel near the convention center, and that was it. Come on, you're missing out on St. Petersburg. You know, you got to get over there on the Nevsky Prospect. You got to go to St. Isaac's. You got to go to the Church on Spilled Blood. You got to visit the place where they tried to assassinate Rasputin. You know, there's so many sites. There's the Fortress of Peter and Paul. There's the Admiralty. There's going down to Catherine the Great's palace, or going to Peterhof, where Peter the Great had his palace. I mean, some of these things are magnificent estates and beautiful things. Now, some people say, well, St. Petersburg is just a museum. Yeah, you know, for the most part, that's true. St. Petersburg is a museum, and it has one of the best museums in the world, the Hermitage. And I know that when I was in St. Petersburg, we had the opportunity to visit the Hermitage. Incredible. Just incredible. And, you know, it was magnificent. It was magnificent from one end to the other. But one of the key things that you find out when you're in St. Petersburg is that St. Petersburg is High Russia. And I don't mean CBD High Russia. I mean High Russia in the respect, like for instance, in Germany, I don't know that this is the case anymore, but it used to be in Germany, you had what was called High German. In Britain, you had the Queen's English. Well, in Russia, you have High Russian Society, which is in really in St. Petersburg. So they have a protocol of tradition and mannerisms that are consistent with what Russian nobility used to do in that city, and you're expected to live up to that standard when you're in St. Petersburg. Moscow, it's a completely different thing. Moscow's an international city. And Moscow, of course, now I think Moscow's about 16 million people. They've built a major commercial district in there. And as Putin said, look, we're bourgeois now. We're bourgeoisie. We're no longer communists. We want to be a part of Europe. We want to engage in trade. We want to be able to go to the beaches with you. We want to be able to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And of course, a lot of people don't understand Russians because Russians can be a little bit blunt in their approach to things, right? And it has to do with the language. But you can also see when you look at this woman who's interviewing Scott Bennett, how pleasant and how alive that vibrant that new culture is in Russia. It's really quite live and quite vibrant. But anyway, yeah, Scott was here and from this post here in St. Petersburg, instead of catching the sights in St. Petersburg, he went down to Belgorod. Now, when you're talking about going down to Belgorod, this is, you know, when you leave, when you come south out of St. Petersburg, you can catch a high speed train down to Moscow. And when you get to Moscow, you get on the more traditional trains. And the traditional trains are slower and they tend to be milk runs. That is to say, they stop, you know, at every little village. But we used to catch the train from Moscow to Kursk. And then you can catch the train from Kursk to Belgorod. And so all of these cities, Bryansk and Kursk and Belgorod, these are in oblasts, which, you know, you might think of them as states that border the Ukrainian border. So it would be like, you know, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas bordering the Mexican border. These states, this Bryansk and Kursk Oblast and Belgorod, they buttress up to Ukraine, at least in part. And so Scott went to Belgorod to witness the kind of damage that was being done by American weapons against civilian targets. And since before this war began, going back into 2014, the Ukrainian government has routinely used American weapons to target civilian targets. And you can see that in Israel right now, we've got a couple of leaders there that have just had arrest warrants issued for them. And the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has instructed all of its members, anyone who is a member of the ICC, that they are required to arrest these two Israeli leaders under these arrest warrants should they enter into their country. And so Italy has already said it's going to, and the Netherlands has already said it's going to. So you can see that these kinds of things are forward moving. And the idea of targeting civilians is an international war crime. And so this is going to be very problematic, ultimately, when jurisprudence comes to visit the Ukrainian nationals. But Scott was in Belgorod, and he did a number of videos live from Belgorod, and even came under attack while he was there. There were bombs that were hitting his hotel while he was there. And so he gave a very strong, very powerful firsthand report. And prior to that, he had also visited Mariupol in Ukraine, which is where the great battle of this SMO. That's the greatest battle of the SMO right there. I mean, some people might say Bakhmut. Some people might say Avdiivka were the great battles. Bakhmut, of course, was a major, major turning point. But the war was lost on behalf of Ukraine when Ukraine lost Mariupol. Mariupol is a seacoast city on the Azov Sea, and it was protected by the Azov Battalion, an immoral group of neo-Nazis that were protecting that town. And Zeluzhny, who, by the way, today, the former head of the Ukrainian military, now an ambassador of Ukraine in the UK, Zeluzhny said, oh, yeah, your World War III has begun. Well, wishful thinking. But Zeluzhny is the one who failed to organize and failed to bring enough troops to bear to defeat the militias of the Donbass militias, which were augmented by Russian troops in Mariupol. And the battle of Mariupol then resulted in the end of the Azov Battalion, at least in that area, and it was recaptured by Russia. And Scott went there to visit Mariupol, and he also was in the Donbass region interviewing Ukrainian prisoners of war. And there's a couple of videos that Scott published, and I think some of these are on Rumble, but Scott published a couple of videos where he was interviewing Ukrainian prisoners of war. And he was just talking to them about their tattoos, you know, about the Gestapo symbolism or the special services symbolism that they had tattooed on their body and overt swastikas and so on and so forth. I mean, it's very clear. I mean, when you see some of these tats, it's very clear what the allegiance is. And they're Banderites, right? Followers of Stepan Bandera, who was the Ukrainian who joined the Hitler's Nazi SS. And was personally responsible for the deaths of 120,000 Ukrainian Jews during his tenure. So this is something that Scott was able to prove, and he gave live reports from Mariupol and also live reports from, I don't think he was in Avdiivka, but he was in Donetsk. And Donetsk is another city that is routinely targeted by by MLRSs. That are coming in American weapons used to fire on civilian targets, things like daycares, movie theaters, apartment buildings, these kinds of things. And they're routinely targeted against civilian infrastructure, war crimes, that they think is going to somehow cause the morale of the other side to collapse, which does not. It just causes them to get angry and to permanently hate the other side that's killing civilians. And so anyway, this was some of the work that Scott did just recently. So you have to keep in mind that in 2024, we're talking July of 2024, Scott was in Belgorod in Russia giving live reports of American munitions being used against civilian targets. Okay. Now here you can see this is Scott actually in Russia, and he's checking out the quality of the body armor that they're later going to have him put on this body armor. Well, this body armor, I mean, you know, you talk about turtle shell stuff. This body armor was heavy body armor. And I guess if you're in a combat zone, you got to keep in mind that the Russians have developed a new Kalashnikov, And these, you know, you might remember the AK-47. It's a very popular weapon. It probably it's the most popular firearm for a military in the world. It's being sold more than any other form. And but the Kalashnikov company has upgraded twice that rifle, and the new Kalashnikovs are really quite incredible weapons, but they fire a high impact round. And when you're talking about a high impact round, I'm talking about the difference between a 223, which is a basically the round is about the size of a 22 round with a lot of gunpowder behind it, as compared to a 308 round, which is a much bigger shell and does a lot more damage. So because these are the kinds of weapons that are used, these Kalashnikovs are used in the field, the body armor is much heavier. So as you can tell, this is got in July in Belgorod, being fitted for Russian armor. Okay. And finally, this is kind of the, Scott Bennett, a friend remembered. And so I want to say this before we go, and before we go, before I leave this discussion with Scott, which is what I'm really what I'm having right now is a discussion with Scott. Scott, you hear me? I know you do, brother. I know you're hearing me. So I'm just gonna share this with you. You know, when we talk about this analysis, let's talk about it now. We would, you know, Scott and I would routinely, we would talk about several fronts. We would talk about what was happening in Europe. We would talk about what was happening in America, what was happening in Ukraine, and of course, what is happening in Israel. And Israel is a very interesting situation. And, you know, I think Israel is now at a point where it's become a make or break establishment. These new criminal warrants that have been or that have been issued for Netanyahu and Gallant, but these warrants are very interesting, and I think these warrants are going to change the tenor because there's a couple of things happening. Number one, Netanyahu is in trouble domestically. He's in the courtroom in Israel, being grilled over a couple of things. One has to do with some bribery accusations that have been on the table for a long time, and the other has to do with some acts of espionage, which he may have done by leaking information from a highly classified document. And these things are not playing well for Netanyahu, because the long and the short of it is that at the thrust of the issue is what happened with the hostages. And did Netanyahu at any time have the opportunity to get the hostages back early on in this conflict? And if he had of, how would that have played out for Gaza? How would that have played out against Hezbollah? How would that have played out against the Houthis? How would that have played out against Iran? How would that have played out in the international sphere of public opinion? Because the international opinion has turned now against Israel horrendously. Now you have really all of Europe, really all of the members of the ICC now, are now have been told by the criminal court, you must arrest these two if they enter into your country. You must. This means that the vast majority of these countries have now turned and said, those were international war crimes, because there's arrest warrants now out for their leadership. And of course, there's plenty of documentation on this about what has happened in Gaza. And the real critical question is, and this is the whole question over this idea of espionage and this classified document. Netanyahu cited this classified document to try to claim that Hamas was making it impossible to get the hostages, that he had no choice but to go into Gaza with overwhelming military force. But that's not what the document says, apparently. And instead, what it says is it indicates that, in fact, Hamas was not going to do that, not going to move the hostages into Iran, but rather was waiting to execute an exchange. Now, nobody wants to talk about it because they say Hamas was just really willing to give hostages up for a ceasefire. That's not true. I don't think that's true. I think Hamas wanted to trade the hostages for the over 1,000 Palestinians that are locked up in Israeli prison. Whoop, there goes my recording. It stopped. Okay, well, we're just going to have to download it from YouTube, I guess. But when you, I believe that Hamas was looking to trade the hostages for Palestinians that were in Israeli jails. And so this arrangement could have been made even as early as October 8th or October 9th. But there was emotional reaction. And I think part of that emotional reaction has to do with another decision that was made by Netanyahu that I'm not sure was lawful under Israeli law either, which is he invoked the Hannibal Doctrine. Now, Hannibal is a very interesting name. A lot of people don't know this. A lot of people, the only Hannibal they know is Hannibal Lecter from Silence of the Lambs. But Hannibal was actually the name of a great general who fought on behalf of the Carthaginians in the Second Punic War, where he came into Europe, into southern France, with a huge body of elephants. And he crossed over the Swiss Alps with his elephants to come and attack Rome. They'd never stood up against elephants before. So it was quite an attacking force, and he succeeded and won that war. But instead of conquering Rome and imposing the Carthaginian way, which thankfully he didn't, it wasn't able to do that, he returned to Carthage. And Rome would then gear up for the Third Punic War, where they would decisively defeat the Carthaginians, burning their city to the ground and salting the earth. The Carthaginians, who were Baali worshippers, were doing things like throwing infants over the sides of the walls when the Romans were approaching in sacrifice to Baal. Well, Hannibal, this great general, this name is actually a Hebrew name, and it's Hine Baal. Behold Baal. Hine Baal. Hine Baal. Or Hannibal. Hannibal. Okay? That's where the name comes from. Okay. So Hine Baal. So at any rate, let me see if I can get back to where we were here. So when we talk about this, I was discussing in Israel. So what you see in Israel is the Hannibal Doctrine. And the Hannibal Doctrine is one that said, it's not widely discussed, but it is out there that if you have a terrorist, that you have the license to open fire on whoever happened to might be there in order to kill the terrorist. And Haaretz, the Jerusalem press, Haaretz, reported that the vast majority of the people that died on October 7th were killed by friendly fire. Whether it came from an Apache helicopter or it came from a Merkava tank, nonetheless, you had friendly fire was responsible for most of the deaths. The story about taking and raping infant babies and burning them and so on and so forth, total fraud, it was a complete lie. They had to retract all of that. So notwithstanding the crime of Hamas, whatever Hamas may have done in that initiation, the vast majority of those deaths occurred because Netanyahu apparently had given the go-ahead for the Hannibal Doctrine. And I don't believe that that is necessarily lawful. I believe that the Israelis may have abandoned that years ago, back in 2009. So you can imagine that Netanyahu now, having unleashed the Hannibal Doctrine, and then having all this tremendous number of casualties at Gaza, got very upset and had to make sure that he pointed the finger at Hamas, Hamas, Hamas. And so there was a lot of emotionalism coming out of that office immediately after that. And the emotionalism was then fueled by the American Defense Department that apparently had a lot of JDAMs they wanted to get rid of. And the next thing you know, Israel is dropping more tonnage on Gaza than was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. And so when we look at this now, this, I think, was a fateful error on the part of Israeli leadership. Netanyahu in particular, it was a very grievous mistake on his part. He should have been a lot less emotional and much more calculating, getting the hostages back first and then exacting military revenge against military targets in Gaza. But that's not what he elected to do. Instead, he elected to inflame this thing. And then this thing inflamed into a broad-based war that is now really quite broad-based. And the war is being fought with advanced munitions that are beyond the American defensive capability. This is what's so critical to understand. these hypersonics that have been developed by Iran and by Russia and now by North Korea and now by China, these hypersonics are capable of traveling faster than any of the air defense machinery we can put in there, whether you're talking Iron Dome or Patriot or THAAD systems. And because of this, the Iranians demonstrated they could hit any target they wanted to in Israel whenever they wanted. And actually, Hezbollah demonstrated the same thing with slow-moving drones, because the drones would come into Israel under the radar of the Iron Dome. And then they were able to actually strike the Iron Dome with drones. And so the drones became effective. The hypersonics became effective. The Houthis launched a drone right into central Tel Aviv from Yemen, for heaven's sakes. I mean, that's a long trip. You know, that's all the way up the Red Sea. But nonetheless, they were able to do that. And now the Houthis have proved to be quite formidable, shooting hypersonic missiles at an American aircraft carrier, the Abraham Lincoln, and two destroyers. Now, the Abraham Lincoln used to dock there in Everett, Washington. So I'm quite familiar with this ship. And so these guys being bombarded with hypersonics for which they could not defend wisely got out of the neighborhood because they're sitting ducks. Why be a sitting duck? And so the Lincoln and the two destroyers left the Red Sea, which, of course, leaves the Red Sea completely decommissioned from freight traffic. And this is going to be a long-term situation, to the point that now South Africa is looking at the idea of developing a new port facility to handle traffic around the Cape of Good Hope, because that's where all the traffic's coming. Okay, and that's going to be a big deal, too. And I think that should be done up at the mouth of the Orange River. You want my opinion? That's just my opinion, but that's what I'm saying. Okay. So when we look at Israel now, so now Netanyahu, instead of like kind of swallowing his pride or figuring out how to dig out of this hole, he instead kept digging. And when he kept digging to expand the battlefront into Beirut, I think was really a huge mistake. There was really no need to do that, but he did. And he decided to engage against Hezbollah. And in engaging against Hezbollah, he's also been routinely targeting targets in Syria that he claims, of course, are Iranian-backed militias inside of Syria. And maybe they are. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Hezbollah goes back there and vacations in Syria. I don't know what the situation is. But we do know that Russia has an advanced base in Syria that it's not going to tolerate being struck by Israeli aircraft. And the same S-400s that targeted the F-35s in Iran are present there in Syria as well. So in doing so, in opening up this battlefront against Hezbollah, Hezbollah has proved quite formidable at the Lebanese border, and they have done massive amounts of damage over the border in northern Israel. So, and I can tell you, when I was in Israel, we liked the area, very much like the area up north of the Galilee. You know, we were talking up around Rosh Pina or Kiryat Shemona, or even Safed. And these places have all been evacuated because they're very close to the Lebanese border, and the Lebanese have just been hitting them with, you know, fire bombing kind of drones. And so you've had literally over 100,000 people evacuate these areas in northern Israel. And whereas it was, I think there was only one strike ever in history in Haifa from Hezbollah, Haifa is routinely being hit now, routinely, as is Tel Aviv being routinely hit, routinely struck by munitions that the Israelis are unable to stop with the Iron Dome or with Patriot or with THAAD. Iran, which has promised to come back and, you know, target Israel, respond to Israel as a result of that attempted sortie over Iran with 100 aircraft, has not yet done that. They've not yet done that. But we do see those armies that are in close relationship with Iran, and I'm not going to call them proxies, but they're in close relationship with Iran, like the Houthis, like Hezbollah, like Hamas. They're ending up with some pretty sophisticated weaponry, a lot of arms, and they're ending up with rockets that the Israelis had not seen before that are coming in and striking the country. All right. Now, so Netanyahu continues to be stiff-necked, common trait in that neck of the woods, stiff-necked individual who is unwilling to yield. And yield he should. Now, I think what's going to happen now, just my opinion, is that the Trump administration, which has been packed with major Israel supporters, One has to distinguish between supporters of Israel and supporters of Netanyahu. They're two different things, particularly in light of the fact that Netanyahu has got his foot in a bowl of hot water there in Israel. And so I think what you're going to see with the Trump administration is that the Trump administration is going to take a position that they're going to do what's necessary to save the nation of Israel from complete destruction, because it's right on the verge of that right now. And I can tell you that even if Trump secures a ceasefire, he's not going to be able to secure a rejuvenation of the Abraham Accords, because Saudi Arabia says we're not getting back into the Abraham Accords until there's a Palestinian state with Jerusalem as its capital. So if there is going to be any Israel saved at all, including all that infrastructure that's been built in Tel Aviv and Haifa and up in Caesarea and in Ashkelon and in Ashdod, all that infrastructure that's been built there, if that's going to be rescued and saved, then a Palestinian state is going to be necessary. It's going to be required. And I think at this point, at this stage of the game, it's not going to be the 1967 borders. It's going to be the 1948 borders that are going to have to be reinstated. And they're going to have to be reinstated in order to make Palestine a successful state. And, of course, there's not going to be any more of this business of having an open-air concentration camp like Gaza, where the Israelis control what comes into their ports, what comes into their gateways into Egypt, what comes into their airport. None of that's going to happen. What's going to have to happen is that, of course, there's going to be an airport in Gaza where there's going to be international traffic flying in and out. There's going to be traffic coming over the Egyptian border. There's going to be vessels coming to shore. And it was Scott Bennett's idea. And Scott would remind you of this if he was here, that he was the one that suggested that Turkey should go down there and build a port and then structure a humanitarian aid flotilla directly into Gaza in the face of Israeli aggression. And of course, the Biden administration heard that and they tried to do it. And of course, they forgot to bring in the Army Corps of Engineers, right? Call the Army Corps of Engineers first if you're going to do that kind of thing. They can help you get it right. Okay. But at any rate, so I think if the Trump administration is going to rescue the nation of Israel, it's going to have to rescue what's left after Netanyahu's been done with it. And it's going to be difficult to do. It's going to be a difficult mission. And it's going to take years to rebuild Israel. I mean, you're talking years. I mean, I think Israel has been set back to 1949. You want to know my opinion? It's gone really way, way back as a result of these horrible decisions made by Benjamin Netanyahu, who ultimately, once he is ousted from office, which is very near, that is very, very near, no matter what his rhetoric may be, his being ousted from office is very, very near. And when that happens, he's going to be standing trial, possibly at Nuremberg. Okay, so that's my analysis on Israel. My analysis on Ukraine is simply this. When you look at Ukraine, what the situation is, Vladimir Zelensky is a dictator over a Nazi state. Their ideology is Nazi. It's atheist Nazi or paganist Nazi. They have criminalized Christianity. They've criminalized the Orthodox Church. They have beaten up priests and stolen artifacts out of the churches. They have engaged in tearing down all of their old monuments and instead erecting and exalting Stepan Bandera, a Nazi. And so the regime has become very much like this, and it's a dictatorship. It's not there's no elections in Ukraine. And so when you hear all these people talking about, we need to protect our democracy, they're a bunch of lion dogs. What they meant was they need to protect their bureaucracy, not their democracy, their bureaucracy, because they're all just bureaucrats. And these bureaucrats want to protect a bureaucracy in Ukraine that includes a money laundering operation where they can all dip their fingers. And should our Elon Musk and Rawashami get involved in an audit, if you want to audit something, audit all that money that went into Ukraine. And when you trace every dollar, you're going to find a whole boatload of suitcases in the hands of American politicians full of hundreds. That's what you're going to find. And I would encourage this new agency of government efficiency, this DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, I would encourage them that when they embark in their audit of the Pentagon, to make sure to spend a great deal of time auditing every dime that went into Ukraine. I mean, look, you can always recapture Zelensky's house in Miami. You can recapture, you can auction off Zelensky's casino there in the northern part of Cyprus. It'd be very easy to get Zelensky's mansion in the UK, just have Prince Charles seize it again and say this was an illegal operation paid with illegal funds. And then somebody could back a Toyota into Zelensky's wife's Bugatti and say, there you go. How about a ding? Yeah, there you go. Anyway, so I would suggest that this is what I would suggest, a real hyper audit of the money spent in Ukraine. And with that hyper audit and with the right attorneys at the DOJ, you're going to find a criminal activity that's going to be shocking. That when you unfold all of that money laundering, you're going to see all those tenets of child trafficking, organ trafficking, sex trafficking, drug trafficking, arms trafficking, all of that stuff coming out of Odessa, one of the most corrupt cities on the planet. Yep. So this is the kind of audit that needs to be done. Now, where Ukraine is concerned, their chances of failing are very, very high right now. Russia has essentially eliminated their electric supply for the winter. And now we're in November, and so it's starting to get cold, and it's going to be a cold, brutal winter throughout November. And you can see the people in Kiev trying to maintain a fierce loyalty to their country. But they're maintaining a fierce loyalty to their country. Now the vast majority of Ukrainians want the war to end. This is the opinion of Ukrainian people today. The vast majority want the war to end. Only dictator Vladimir Zelensky, who is another person engaged in war crimes, who ultimately will face an indictment at the International Criminal Court, Zelensky is, in the meantime, saying, oh, no, we're going to perpetrate this. We're going to call Russia's bluff on whether or not it's going to use nuclear weapons. Does America really want a guy, a former comedian who used to play the piano with his penis, making the decision about whether or not we're going to be involved in a nuclear holocaust with Russia? Is that who we want making the decision? Didn't Congress have something to say about this somewhere? Doesn't Congress have the right to declare war or not to declare war? Who is the president to drag us into a nuclear war with Russia? Why is there no congressional oversight? Now, there's already been some discussion about impeaching Biden and impeaching most of his cabinet members for allowing Zelensky to shoot ATACMs deep into Russia after Russia warned that they weren't going to put up with that. Now, of course, the ATACMs were not armed with nuclear missiles, with nuclear warheads. They could have been, but they were not. And some of the cruise missiles that they're attempting to put in, like some of the short-range missiles they put into Poland, have now been answered by Russia with this Oreshnik hypersonic MIRVed ICBM that was used yesterday. And so here we are. We've got a situation going where, yeah, you could have armed up your long-range missiles into Russia with nuclear weapons. And if you had, those would have been 25, 75 kiloton nuclear warheads going off rather than 25 dummies demonstrating the efficacy of the missile. So in my opinion, Zelensky's bid in Kursk was a complete failure. Now, recently, the Pentagon came out and said, look, the intermediate range missile is not our problem. It's North Koreans in Ukraine is our problem. There are no North Koreans in Ukraine. The North Koreans are in Russia. The invading army is Ukraine. Now, I want to try to make this clear. This is analysis I would be giving to Scott on Wednesday night. I'm going to make this analysis here. What you see is with Russia, in the United States Constitution and in the British common law, there's a thing called letters of marque and reprisal. Letters of marque and reprisal. Now, marque and reprisal is a condition that is something less than war. When you do marque and reprisal, you essentially say, we're going to take some steps that are less than war against some foreign power because they are oppressing our people. Whether it be that they've got, whether you've got a colony, for instance, in the Falkland Islands that's being overtaken by the Argentinians, and the UK wants to issue a letter of marque and reprisal to go down there and secure those Englishmen living on that island, or whether you're talking about the Russian speakers in the Donbass who were targeted for extermination by the vocalization of Poroshenko, which, by the way, was the intent to commit genocide. That came out of his mouth. Our children are going to be in schools. Your children are going to be in basements. That's what he said. And they criminalized the speaking of the Russian language. Well, this became an act of oppression against Russian-speaking people. It's an act of genocide. And Russia took the position that they're going to engage in what we would call Markham reprisal to secure its oppressed people from a intended genocide. And by the way, when Russia went in, they went in 2 weeks ahead of when Zelensky was planning on moving a 750,000 man army into the Donbass to eliminate Russian speaking people. And so you got to keep this in mind. Now, when you talk about Markham reprisal, because this is what's gone on as a matter of law, this is well understood in international law, by the way, in international law circles. The Russians call it an SMO. But it would be Markham reprisal if it was being done by the Crown, Markham reprisal if it was being done by the United States. This is something less than war. This is securing oppressed people belonging under the tutelage of whatever country it is that's issued the Markham reprisal. And our reaction to this was to now turn this into a proxy war where we could cost Russia blood blood and money. And cause them to fail, cause them to be tired, cause them to wear out, cause their economy to fail, cause them to be isolated, on and on and on. Well, the Russians have completely outplayed us on that chessboard entirely. I mean, we're down to, the king, one rook and two pawns. And the Russians are still playing with both bishops, both knights, both rooks and the queen. And so this is the circumstance on the chessboard right now. And so as a consequence, the Markham reprisal should be understood by the West as what it is. And if we understand what that is, you can see that the Russians have played very much of this according to Hoyle, which is to say, you don't see Russian troops advancing outside of the boundaries of Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, or Luhansk, or the Crimea for that matter. They're operating within those boundaries. That's where all the battles are being fought. That's where Avdiivka was located. That's where Bakhmut was located. That's where Mariupol was located. All in those areas. That's where the battles are going on this very day. The Russians are advancing to secure what's left of those oblasts into the hands of Russia to expel Ukrainian troops from that. Ukraine, on the other hand, did something entirely different. Ukraine invaded Russia with Ukrainian troops, and they weren't all Ukrainians. In fact, I'm not even sure they were even a majority Ukrainians. There were many, many mercenaries, special forces belonging to NATO that were, putting themselves under Ukrainian command to go into Kursk and to launch an attempt to sabotage a nuclear reactor in order to maximize civilian deaths. Okay, that's not a military. A nuclear reactor is not a military target. You're targeting something that is going to maximize civilian deaths. And they were stopped before they could do that. And they had been able to maintain some occupancy in the woods. And so when North Korean troops are introduced into that battlefield to fight against Ukrainians on Russian soil, that is not North Korea's involvement in a war against Ukraine. North Korea hasn't entered Ukraine. North Korea is merely participating with a police action inside the Russian state. Okay? That's different than having an invading army coming in over the Ukrainian border. And so this is what the ATACMS attack was all about. It was about firing behind those lines in Bryansk to try to force the Russians to retreat back to that area for purposes of defense. It's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever played chess where you've moved a knight down and you've succeeded in getting your knight into the back row by putting a triple jeopardy on either the queen or the bishop. And your opponent moves the queen, so you take the bishop. And this is very possible, but when you're in the back row, you're very susceptible to that rook coming over and taking your head off right there. And so this is what has happened. So now they're losing somewhere between 150 to 200 troops a day, the Ukrainians are, in this Kursk region. And ultimately, they're going to be completely destroyed in that region. And that was their strategic defense force. But the idea of Vladimir Zelensky was to attack Russia and to prove to NATO that if you guys keep putting your troops in there, if you keep fueling that beachhead in Kursk by putting more and more mercenaries in there, Russia will eventually get used to the fact that NATO troops are on Russian soil, and they still will not have reacted to the nuclear weapon. You see, this is the thinking of Vladimir Zelensky. Now, what is most likely going to happen is that all of those forces inside the Kursk region are going to be completely expunged. There won't be any of them left. And it's surrender or die, and what the situation is, because they're not going to be able to run back over the border because it's completely sealed. And in the meantime, North Korea gets, you know, battle experience for 50,000 troops, which is what they're looking for. They want their troops to have some battle experience. Remember that North Korea is preparing for war with South Korea, having blown up all the bridges and all the roads connecting North and South Korea just recently. Okay, so this is what this situation looks like. Now, Joe Biden should face immediate impeachment. The Republicans should immediately impeach him and put him on the ropes. And the reason he should be impeached is because if they impeach him now for this decision to allow Ukraine to attempt to drag us into a nuclear war with Russia without congressional authorization, if Biden can be impeached for that, and most of his cabinet who participated in that decision also being impeached, then at least you have them on the ropes, so they're not going to make a similar decision again. They shouldn't. You should be able to have them in a situation where you guys are one vote away from being thrown out of office. And so this is where I think that's where that needs to go. Now, in the meantime, in the UK, you have Keir Starmer, who is no longer representing the English people. He's no longer representing Britain at all. And I think the plan in Britain, and again, he is representing the banks, and that's who he represents and no one else. When the banks are contemplating the idea of putting together a conscription in Britain, and they're going to draft. And who are they going to draft? Well, one of the groups that's going to get drafted is going to be the illegals that have crossed over the border. That's part of the reason why the borders have been made porous in the United Kingdom. And many of those that thought they had escaped the war are included Ukrainian refugees that are all over Ireland and all over England and all over Scotland. Many of those are going to end up being drafted into the UK army and shipped right back into Ukraine to fight. This, at least in Keir Starmer's imagination, is what's going to happen. Of course, the Russians already told Keir Starmer, and they told him unequivocally, and now they've proved him that they have the weapons to do it. We will completely destroy London and Birmingham and Manchester and Devonport and Clyde and these other targets, all of your strategic targets, we're going to destroy in the first strike. And this particular Oreshnik missile can arrive there in 11 minutes with 24 nuclear warheads on board, traveling at 7,500 miles an hour. So you would hope that someone, including someone in Keir Starmer's office, would get that message. But, you know, Keir Starmer he's got his headphones in. He's got his headphones on, and they're the Bose noise reduction headphones. And the only station he's listening to is station Rothschild. So don't count on him hearing a thing from anyone else. All right. So at any rate, we're at a very pivotal time right now. And in this pivotal time, Vladimir Putin always seems to engineer another day of life for the West. No matter how much the West wants to commit suicide in a nuclear war, Putin manages to engineer another day of life for us. And so someday we're going to be friends. Someday we're going to be friends. Someday you guys are going to be able to fly into Russia for a vacation, and it's going to be no problem and no difficulty. And you're going to be able to go in there and enjoy it. And you're going to be able to buy yourself some furs so you can stay warm while you're there. All right. So, Scott, let me say this to you, brother. May Yah have already said to you, well done, good and faithful servant. May Yah have already said that to you. May you have already heard those words. And, you know, may Yah bless you and keep you, wrap his arms around you and say, welcome home. And, you know, Scott, you know, we don't know the hour when we're coming home. We don't know the hour where we've been. We don't know the hour that Yah has picked for us, the hour, the day, the minute, the second, right? But in those times, you know, recognize, Scott, I mean, and if no one else wants to recognize it, let me say it to you. You know, you did a great job. During your life, you succeeded in great academic credentials. You rose into the echelons of power or into the echelons of military service on behalf of this country, a true honorable officer of the U.S. military, an honorable officer of the U.S. military, doing your job even after your commission had expired, staying true to your oath and standing up on behalf of freedom and standing up on behalf of the things that we know are right and true. And that you were a warrior for the truth, not denying the truth, but a warrior for the truth. And in that respect, I can tell you, we're going to miss your voice. We're going to miss your voice. That is a fact, brother. So, hopefully I'm going to run into you again at a place that is a lot warmer than it is here, but not that warm, right? Just kinder, nicer, more comfortable, a good place. Anyway, good to see you again, my brother Scott Bennett. And with that, my friends, I am going to wrap up this discussion tonight. I hope you've enjoyed this program, and I also hope that we don't get taken down before the ink dries for something that I said earlier on. And let's just see what happens. Okay, all right, guys. So if somebody has any kind of questions, I'm interested in taking some questions. But otherwise, I think what we'll do is we'll just say what Sherry Pavin said. Amen, amen, regarding Scott. Okay. All right, brothers and sisters, I'm going to say goodnight then, and we will see you next, we will not see you next week for several moments, because I will be giving thanks to Yah for my family, for all of my children, and I just want to say thank you for all my children, including the beloved Teresa, and the beloved Ilana, and the beloved Olivia, and the beloved Katie, and the beloved Alex, and the beloved Lewis, and the beloved grandsons. I want to say thanks to Yah for those. I want to say thanks for my wife and my immediate family, including all her brother and her sister, and my brother-in-law and my sons-in-law, who I have the greatest of respect for. I love them dearly, and I just want to say that I'm going to say thanks for that. And I'm going to take that time to sit down with my family and to have a meal and to give thanks to Yah, saying, Yadayawa kitov ki laolam chastu. We thank you, Yah, for you are good and your mercy endures forever. Okay, hallelujah, my friends, and we will see you later. Bye-bye.